It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Officials held a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the so-called Zoo Interchange west of Milwaukee. It's been years of highway construction, and Governor Walker celebrated its completion on Monday. Except it's not exactly complete. Nate Beck is a reporter at the Daily Reporter, which covers construction news in Wisconsin. He wrote about this ribbon-cutting ceremony, and he is with us today. Nate, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So for those of us outside of Milwaukee who may not be familiar with the Zoo Interchange, describe it for us.
So the Zoo Interchange is among the largest highway projects that the state has undertaken. It's about a $1.7 billion project, and it got underway in 2013. The project would repair the busiest stretch of highway in the state, which carries about 350,000 cars a day. So big project.
So where do these cars come from? Do we know that? Are they mostly Wisconsin people, or are they coming from south?
So, yeah, it's in addition to being a big commuter route, it's also a big transit route. So you'll get a lot of truck traffic from Illinois going through Wisconsin to kind of the northern part of the state. So, in addition to carrying a lot of, commuters and travelers and that kind of thing, it also, is a big route for commerce as well.
And Zoo, where does the name Zoo come from?
Well, it runs right next to the Milwaukee County Zoo.
There you go.
So there you go.
So it's not a commentary on the snarl of traffic. It just runs through the zoo.
No. I guess that would be unintentional.
Okay. So this started in 2013. There were different phases, I understand. Are all the phases complete?
They are not. I guess Walker's announcement on Monday would have christened the completion of the second phase of the core of the project. The first phase of the core got wrapped up in 2016, and now they've completed the second phase here this month. There's still one more phase to go, and that's the north leg, and that project is stalled currently after a measure passed during the 2017 budget negotiations that would kind of freeze out funding for the final leg. So that kind of final section has yet to be budgeted for.
Okay, so that brings a number of questions. First of all, didn't we get federal highway money to do this?
Right. So federal highway officials said on Monday that the feds are going to kick in about $450 million for the whole project. For the last leg, the north leg of the project, the DOT initially expected it to cost about $200 million back in 2017. I guess some critics warned that if it didn't get funding in that phase, the price tag could go up. I guess the DOT put out an estimate here, I guess, in early August where that kind of seems to be the case. Hmm. Now it looks like finishing the final leg will cost about $230 million.
So why did it go up? I don't understand. If you don't fund it, you don't get the discount rate if you don't fund it early enough? I don't get it.
Yeah, so I guess the longer you wait, critics will argue, the more you'll pay in real costs, and that's sort of partially due to inflation, kind of this updated figure, this $230 million figure, takes into account about $7.7 million in inflation. There's also, a $21.6 million contingency cost that's sort of tacked on to the higher estimates. I guess this is something that critics will say is sort of the longer you wait to get a project underway, the higher your costs are in the long term.
So who lives, where, what suburbs are in this North Interchange, and how is it affecting them? And have you talked to people who live there?
Yeah, so the project, it runs right along Brookfield, Wauwatosa, Milwaukee, so it's a heavily traveled area. There's a lot of people who work and live along this corridor. Construction has, kind of been a constant fixture for folks who kind of rely on this this roadway to get where they're trying to go.
Right, for 5 years now. So how do they feel about, do we know when they're going to be finishing the construction on the North Leg, or is it just kind of up in the air and they'll fight it out next year in the legislature?
Well, the DOT, is anticipating that work will get underway sometime in 2020 and wrap up in 2022 or 2023. But really, that all depends on whether the money's there. And at this point, it's not. So we'll just kind of have to wait and see.
So this, since 2013, and I assume before when they were talking about it, this has been a controversial project. That word has been thrown out a lot to label this project. Why?
I think it's, it's a big project, heavy price tag. Just in that context alone, if you're spending a lot of money, there's kind of a lot to be skeptical of.
Walker on Monday said that the second leg where he was cutting the ribbon was on time and on budget. Is that true?
I think it's generally accurate that, it wrapped up on time. I think people are, generally feel like it's been done kind of efficiently this final leg, but then again, kind of the main critique here is that it's not totally done.
Right. So Scott Walker is obviously in a campaign for re-election. He's running against Tony Evers. Evers and his fellow Democrats have not quite released their plans for how to fund roads and road projects in Wisconsin. But have they hinted about how they would handle projects like this in the future?
Well, as you say, they haven't released their road funding plan, yet. But I guess I'd expect to see projects like the Zoo Interchange kind of become a fixture, as November draws closer. Last week, the Evers campaign went on a tour with a couple prominent construction unions around the state to kind of critique Walker over his transportation funding priorities. But yeah, as you say, they haven't released a plan of their own, saying only that all options are on the table. Walker said on Monday that if Evers wants to raise the gas tax, he should tell voters that. The campaign, meanwhile, says that it's an early they're just a week or so into the general election here, and there's no specifics yet.
We have been talking to Nate Beck. He is a reporter at The Daily Reporter, and he covers construction news in Wisconsin and specifically covered the completion of the second leg of the Zoo project. But there is a third leg still yet to come, and we're not really sure when that will be completed. Nate, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you much.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're going to start this segment listening to a scene from the 1991 movie, The Doctor.
I have a grade 4 brain tumor. It took my doctors 3 months to find it. I didn't take that so well at all. Actually, they didn't find it. I rear-ended a few cars, fell over, blacked out. Short of the tumor jumping out and singing, there was nothing else it could do to get recognized. See, now I'd call that negligence, wouldn't you?
That was the incomparable Elizabeth Perkins talking about how her legitimate concerns were dismissed by her doctors. Short of the tumor jumping out and singing, there was nothing else it could do to get recognized. One of my next guests has a name for this, healthcare gaslighting, and it disproportionately affects white women and women and men of color. Sasha Adi had doctors discard her concerns when she was diagnosed with polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCOS. She was so outraged, she started the PCOS challenge to draw more attention to the syndrome. Sasha, welcome to the program. We're still getting her on the line here. We're also being joined.
Welcome.
Hey, hi. Sasha, are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
Yay.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
We're also being joined by Catherine Sharif. She is a professor at the Sidney Kimball Medical School at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. She is the director of Jefferson Women's Primary Care and the vice chair of the Department of Medicine at Jefferson University Hospitals. Dr. Sharif, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
And we seem to have lost Sasha again. So
I am here.
She's on. I see. So I'm looking at two different screens. She's on Skype with us. So let's start with your experience. Tell me your story with PCOS.
So I got diagnosed in PCOS in my late 20s. I went to an OBGYN because I stopped getting my period. Mm-hmm. And so she did all the tests, test my hormones, did an ultrasound, and diagnosed me with polycystic ovary syndrome. Then she proceeded to tell me, just come back to see me when you're trying to conceive. Lots of women would love not having their periods. So don't worry about it. Just come back to see me when you're trying to conceive. Hmm. And so I felt dismissed at this point. I felt that my concerns weren't taken seriously, even though she may have had good intentions. If you know about PCOS, PCOS affects much more than just your fertility. It's a lifelong condition that this was a missed opportunity for my doctor to tell me of better ways to manage the condition.
So I want to make clear, despite the clip that we ran earlier from a dramatic movie that may or may not have been totally medically correct, PCOS is not deadly. You can't necessarily die from it, but it does have a lot of issues connected to it. Talk to me about what those are.
Well, you know, we get asked this question all the time. Do you die from PCOS? The answer is eventually you can if it goes unmanaged. If you get some of the complications such as or comorbidities such as diabetes or heart disease or fatty liver disease. So PCOS is a serious condition that can affect your fertility and your long-term health. Some of the symptoms associated with PCOS include irregular cycles, include infertility, include weight gain, hair loss, unwanted excess hair growth, and mental health disorders such as diabetes such as depression, anxiety, bipolar disorders. So, yes, it's a very serious condition. And, you know, some women think that their concerns with PCOS are going unheard because of this rhetoric that it's not deadly. But it is. It's deadly to someone who is suffering from suicidal thoughts and severe anxiety, depression, and other serious disorders associated with PCOS.
Good point. Dr. Sharif, you treat women primarily, and you see this syndrome a lot. What is it exactly?
Well, there's no one test for polycystic ovary syndrome, and The name is a misnomer because not everyone has many cysts on their ovaries. But basically, the accepted definition of the syndrome is a history of irregular periods, meaning they don't come once a month. Secondly, it would be signs of high testosterone, such as hair loss on your scalp or excess hair in other places where women and girls don't usually get it. Or if you don't have those, you have high blood levels of male hormones like testosterone and DHEA sulfate. And then thirdly, you have cysts on your ovaries that are like a string of pearls. They're on the periphery of the ovary. Mm. And most of us accept that you can have two out of three in order to have the diagnosis of PCOS.
Hair where it doesn't grow usually for women, like on the face, where else?
Face, upper arms, on the back. A lot of women actually have low back hair, but that's different from hair higher up. That's more of a male distribution. A lot of women have hair around their nipples, and that is not due to high testosterone. That's actually pretty common. But if you have hair more towards the midline of your body, even if you just have a few spiky hairs on your chest, that's pretty unusual for women.
Hmm.
And it indicates that you have high male hormones.
It occurs to me, as Sasha was talking, that if you have a cyst in your ovaries, and from my understanding, cysts in your ovaries are simply eggs that haven't popped, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And if you have them, are you more prone for ovarian cancer?
You are absolutely not more prone to ovarian cancer if you have cysts in your ovaries. They just sit there and they do nothing. Often they're reabsorbed in the body. These are the polycystic ovary cysts. What happens is you have these eggs, these follicles that were trying to become the egg of the month. They see all this testosterone and they get confused and they stop developing. They stop at a certain point. This is different from functional cysts, which are the ones that can bother you at different times during the month. They are larger. They're more than a centimeter, and they occasionally burst. But either way, no increase in ovarian cancer.
Okay, that's good to know. So at this point, Sasha talked about her doctor kind of dismissing her and saying, "Well, when you want to give birth, let me know." Because the message she seemed to have gotten was the only important thing about you is the possibility that you might give birth to someone someday. But what other things did that doctor need to take into account? What questions should Sasha have asked, perhaps, and other people who may be diagnosed with this?
This happens every day. Women go to their doctors, gynecologists or primary care doctors, and complain about irregular periods. Often they're told it's stress, or number two, they'll grow out of it, or they may even be told that it's polycystic ovary syndrome, that the treatment is the pill, and come back when you want to conceive. And what it shows is a lack of ignorance about the complexity of PCOS and the potential complications. If men had a disorder that affected every single system in their body and could lead to early death, we would have a lot more research in this area. But because it's women, and because it's it appears to be just, quote unquote, a reproductive problem, there's very little research and very little knowledge. So it has been viewed as a reproductive disorder, meaning irregular periods, which means difficulty getting pregnant. But in fact, as Sasha mentioned, it's a metabolic disorder, and women go on to get elevated blood pressures and elevated glucose, and become pre-diabetic and then diabetic. And then as soon as you become diabetic, your chances of developing heart disease, heart attack and stroke increase exponentially.
Okay, so...
It also causes... Yeah.
Go ahead.
It also causes fatty liver. And so When I first started practicing in the early 90s, I never saw fatty liver. And if someone had abnormal liver function tests, it's because they were alcoholic or had hepatitis B. Now I see it every single day.
Oh, wow.
And I would say that at least half of my patients, thousands of patients with PCOS have fatty liver. And the problem is that when you're pre-diabetic and you don't metabolize glucose efficiently, you end up with fat in the liver. And over time, this is destructive to the liver. And the number one cause of liver transplants is going to be fatty liver.
Okay, I'm going to follow that when we come back from break, because you just went somewhere that I really wasn't expecting. We are talking about doctor-patient communication, or lack thereof. We're going to be back with Sasha Adi from PCOS Challenge and Dr. Catherine Sharif in a moment. And we're going to be taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about what one of my guests calls healthcare gaslighting, dismissing patient concerns when a doctor doesn't know the answer, or perhaps knows the answer too well and is puzzled as to why the patient might want to know more. Has this happened to you? Do you feel this happens to you because you're a woman? Do you feel your doctors have a clear understanding of syndromes and diseases that affect Black or Hispanic populations more than white European populations? Give us a call here, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are talking to Sasha Adi of the PCOS Challenge and Catherine Sharif, who is a doctor at Jefferson University Hospitals in Philadelphia. I want to follow up, Dr. Sharif, one thing here with PCOS. You said that you are seeing more fatty livers than you did 25 years ago. And I'm wondering if, A, why, and B, if this is an opportunity for doctors, for clinicians, to be able to contribute to the research of a disease. And is that what you're doing?
Yes, that's correct. I am seeing more fatty liver. It was so rare. And to see fatty liver when I first started practicing in the 90s, and it was related to alcohol. Now we have a name, non-alcoholic liver disease. And it's because we're heavier as a society, which makes us more pre-diabetic, which makes us unable to handle glucose correctly, which is turned to fat and deposited in the liver. And now we're going to have more liver transplants due to years and years of fatty liver. And I'll bet that a large proportion of women with fatty liver disease who are getting transplants had PCOS years ago, and it was never diagnosed.
So my question is,
the brakes on this.
Okay, so my question is, they had that in the 70s, right? Their polycystic ovary syndrome existed then. It existed in the 80s. Why is it that things have changed?
Well, I think that as a society, we are heavier, and you may have come across the statistic that most people now are 20 pounds heavier than they would have been if they were this age 20 years ago. And so I believe that when we gain a little bit of weight, we unmask PCOS. And so we have more PCOS than we used to.
So, Sasha, one of the things that your doctor told you is you need to lose weight. But isn't a gaining weight kind of part of the syndrome?
Well, yeah, that happens for some women. They'll tell you they've gained 60 pounds almost overnight, or they have extreme difficulty losing weight. And in my case, when I saw an endocrinologist, he told me to lose weight and come back to see him in 6 months. However, when I tried to see a dietitian or nutritionist, my health insurance would not pay for me to see a nutrition specialist because I wasn't diabetic. So here's the huge problem of prevention not being prioritized in healthcare. And then so I was left to my own devices. And this is commonplace in U.S. medicine and other parts of the world where you're told that you need to lose weight and then you're left to your own devices to solve the problem on your own. And I think Dr. Sharif can tell you that it's not that easy in PCOS to lose weight. And also there are I'd love Dr. Sharif to talk about this. There are lean women with PCOS. There are mm-hmm. many women with PCOS who do not appear to be overweight, who are not fat or don't have obesity, yet they still have PCOS. So there's something else brewing under the surface of PCOS that can also be independent of whether or not you have excess weight.
So I want to get off PCOS in particular for the moment. I want to talk about how doctors communicate with their patients and how patients also communicate with their doctors. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're looking for patients who feel that they have been unheard, but we're also looking for doctors who feel like maybe the system works against being able to communicate fully with your patients as you would want to do, as you were maybe taught to do in med school. 800-642-1234. I want to play some audio here. There's a podcast put out by KCRW in Santa Monica. It's called Bodies. And the series that they're working on now, which is really good, is called What's Wrong With Me? But the answers so far in the first three episodes are that the medical system either didn't know what was wrong or didn't ask enough questions. And this is a clip of a woman named Kalalia. She has had debilitating menstrual cycles since she was a teenager, pain, heavy bleeding that would necessitate her missing work or school. She was eventually diagnosed with uterine fibroids. This is probably about 20 years later. Uterine fibroids disproportionately affect Black women. Here she is talking about her encounter with a doctor after an episode where she had bled so much that she fainted.
Have you bumped your head lately? Do you play any sports? How about your period? Is it normal? And I said to him, well, what is normal? You know, I don't know. I guess I do have a fair amount of bleeding and pain during my cycle, but doesn't every woman?
Doesn't every woman. So, Dr. Sharif, the interesting thing about this is that this was normal to her from the beginning. She would have these debilitating periods. Nobody thought to say to her, what is actually going on? And she didn't think to ask the questions. So what questions would you have asked her had she been sitting in front of you?
I would get very specific, because if you ask people, are your periods irregular, they may say, yeah, they're regular. You know, they come every couple of months and, you know, I bleed for 2 weeks, right? So I would ask specifically, do your periods come once a month? How many days do you bleed? Do you think you bleed more than other women? And so on. How severe is the pain? Do you actually have to stay home from school or work because the pain is so severe? So we need to get very specific.
Sasha, have you, as you've been going through the PCOS and starting your organization, how many doctors besides Dr. Sharif have you found that are that specific?
We have a relationship with some of the best doctors in the field. So there are some, and they are very vigilant. And however, we hear the horror stories every day about women who are just not listened to or gaslighted, which means, you know, the majority of the physicians that they saw until they got to the point where they've met a Dr. Sharif, this could have been years or decades, mm-hmm. even, were not were dismissing them and even giving them harmful advice.
I want to play another clip from KCRW's Bodies podcast. This is also featuring Kalalea.
Black bodies, black people, black women are just not as important as other people in this country.
Sasha, have you seen this from healthcare providers?
My husband said something to me the other day. He said he's been to many doctor's appointments with me, and he's noticed that until I told them what my degree was or what my background was, some of them wouldn't take me seriously, or they would assume that I didn't know much, and, you know, without knowing much about me. So what I showed up as is a black woman who maybe who's overweight, you know, that and, you know, some people do have, you know, this opinion that sometimes black women may not be as knowledgeable. They may be doing this to themselves. I watched a TED talk from Dr. Peter Attia, who gave a story about how he made assumptions about his diabetic patient because she was overweight or she was fat, and that she did this to herself. So that's, you know, a lot of black women, a lot of women in general feel this, especially if you are a woman of color or a woman in a bigger body.
You worked for the NIH before founding PCOS Challenge. Did you see this happening, this kind of, you know, subtle racism happening in your work there?
Well, my work there was not in a clinical capacity. Mm. It was in research. I pretty much worked alone.
You had a microscope.
I didn't work with patients.
You had a microscope and petri dishes and things like that.
I worked with microscopes. Those are my friends.
Dr. Sharif, people from different ethnic backgrounds often have diseases or syndromes that are more prevalent. Sickle cell anemia is one that comes to mind. Tay-Sachs disease is another. When researchers tackle a disease, are they keeping this in mind?
Not necessarily. And you have to remember that researchers and clinicians are part of our larger society, which is sexist and racist, and they bring that unconscious bias into their work.
We are talking about doctors and patients communicating. Sasha Adi from PCOS Challenge calls this a healthcare gaslighting. We're also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. It's the Ideas Network at ideas@WPR.org or WPR Mornings. We're going to be back to talk about maybe some of the systemic challenges within the medical system that stop doctors who really want to communicate with their patients from doing so. We'll be back in a moment. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about how well doctors and patients communicate in the healthcare system. Do you feel like you're not heard by your doctor? Or are you a doc? Do you deal with burnout and a lack of time to actually communicate with your patients? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are here this morning with Sasha Adi, who is the executive director of PCOS Challenge. That is polycystic ovary syndrome. Catherine Sharif is a doctor at Jefferson University Hospitals in Philadelphia. We've got some callers in, and I would like to take Charlotte from Brookfield. Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
So what is your story?
You know what? I was just telling the operator that I was taking my daughter, who's still ill because we can't seem to find a doctor to help us. And I remember when she was 5 years old, and she had a blood pressure of 146 over, I think it was 80 or something.
Wow.
So they kept, I asked her, the nurse, to check it again, and she did, and it was the same. And when the doctor came in, the nurse never said anything to him. And then I asked the doctor about the blood pressure. He checked it again, and he just kind of shrugged his shoulders. Like, and I was thinking to myself, that is high for a child.
Right.
You know what I mean? But he didn't say anything. And then we talked about losing weight for my daughter. And he said, we got this great program. Oh, my gosh, it's so successful. And he opened his folder, looked to the side of it, and he said, oh, you have this insurance. I can't offer you this.
Ooh.
So, and he closed his folder and said, well, maybe you could find something to help her with it. You know, and I was just like, oh, my gosh. I almost took an ad out in the newspaper to find out, is there any doctors out there that would care for us?
And what is your daughter okay?
Yeah. You know what? It's been going on since she was a little girl. And she got diagnosed 4 years ago with an autoimmune disorder.
Hmm.
So, and it, one of the symptoms is called POTS.
Okay.
I don't know if anyone's ever heard of that. I can't even say the word. But we're hoping to be healed soon. So hopefully.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. Dr. Sharif, do you hear these kinds of stories a lot? My insurance won't cover it?
Yes, everything that your caller has mentioned, which is indifference, callousness, a lack of caring, no curiosity to get to the bottom of this problem. And, you know, we're talking a child here. And then let's say that the doctor was caring, and then insurance doesn't cover something. There are so many obstacles at every point, whether it's your medications are covered or not, whether there is care, mental health care, or nutrition care, two of the most important things. We're in the dark ages about mental health care, and it's hard to get care even if you have the money to afford a therapist or a psychiatrist. It's so frustrating for me to hear this day after day.
We are taking your calls, talking about how well doctors and patients communicate. 800-642-1234. George from Slinger, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning. I just called to say I've been in healthcare since 1984. I'm an advanced practice nurse, what's called a clinical nurse specialist. I've worked clinically both, clinically and administratively. And one of the things, I mean, people have talked about a lot on your program so far, but another factor, it's all multi-factor, as your doctor said and all that. But, you know, the system's kind of been stacked a little bit against providers. I've seen the squeeze go from seeing, you know, patients in 30 minutes to 20 to 15, and I even heard 12. So it really kind of prevents communication. And as a VA vet, I went to a VA clinic like about a year ago or so, and it just really sticks in my mind because my doctor actually sat and talked to me for about 45 minutes.
Wow.
And it just kind of blew me away because I couldn't really, you know, it was so unusual to spend so much time. It's almost culturally something we don't do as doctors and patients. So that's my comment.
Thank you, George, for that. Thank you for two things. First of all, a good story about the VA. We don't hear those that often. And second of all, Dr. Sharif, it used to be 30 minutes that doctors would sit with their patients, and then it got cut down to 15. He's even heard 12. Where's that pressure coming from?
It's economic pressure. So I'll give you an example. If my patient comes to see me, she has a copay of $5. And let's say I'm going to see 10 patients in the morning, and the copays are $5 a piece. That's 50, so 10 patients times $5 is $50. Well, let's make it $10. They have a $10 copay, and I have 10 patients. accepts $100 for the work that I do in that morning. Now, you can't pay anyone when you make that kind of revenue. And so what happens is that physicians need and clinicians need to see more people in order to just break even. And that's because the reimbursements are so low. And so, but you're paying a lot of money for your health insurance. So where's the money? And the answer is that the insurance companies are making record profits. And we have no business tying healthcare to a profit-making enterprise. And so the squeeze is on the doctors, the clinicians, the nurse practitioners, and on the patients. So the doctors or the clinicians are frustrated because they can't spend more time. And then the patients are frustrated because they don't get more time. If I spend the time with you that you need in my office, I run late. Mm-hmm. And if I run late, my patients are irritated and say, you don't respect my time, and you should run on time. It's a no-win situation.
So
a lot of anger.
Yes? Okay, so you told me a story when I was talking to you to research this this conversation about somebody who just wants to get her meds renewed, meds that she's been taking for 10 years. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is a scenario that happens every day. Someone, either I see her in the office or she calls and she says, I want a renewal of my blood pressure medicine X. So I just send the renewal in, no problem. We do it electronically. But then what happens is she goes to the pharmacy and the pharmacist says, oh, we didn't fill it. And it's not covered. So then the patient calls us and she's irate. Why? Did you forget to call it in? Or they'll yell at the staff, you don't give Dr. Sharif any of her messages. I called for a refill. You said it would be taken care of yesterday, and it wasn't taken care of. What's wrong with your office? What's wrong with the staff? So then we have to call the pharmacy and say, we called this in. Why didn't you fill it? Oh, we didn't fill it because it isn't covered. What do you mean it isn't covered? She's been taking it for 10 years. Well, it was rejected. Now the insurance company is not covering it. Okay, so then the patient says, I can't believe you would prescribe something that wasn't covered. Well, we didn't know that. We have no idea. So then we call the insurance company, and the insurance company has now made a deal with another company to cover a similar medication, but, of course, no one told us, so it doesn't come up until it's rejected.
Hmm.
And you can imagine the waste of time and resources it takes to go back and forth and back and forth. So let's say... okay, so now I have to start the patient on a new drug.
Okay.
That means more visits, more monitoring of her blood pressure. In the meantime, the patient's satisfaction is really plummeting because she thinks, what is going on?
Doesn't okay, thank you. I'm going to have to stop you there. I appreciate that. We're going to do something further on doctor burnout. I think that's the next step in this story. Sasha Adi joined us. She is from PCOS Challenge. And we were also joined by Dr. Catherine Sharif, who you just heard. She is a doctor at Jefferson University Hospitals. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having
Thank you for having us.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network.